Welcome to the next in the series of podcasts from the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, published by Oxford University Press. The 23rd of April is St George's Day, which is now becoming an opportunity to celebrate English national culture and character. To mark the day, we present the life story of another epitomist of Englishness and later Britishness, the fictitious 18th century character of John Bull. Once you've listened to this life of John Bull, why not visit the dictionary online at www.oxforddnb.com? The Oxford Dictionary of National Biography includes entries on more than 56,000 men and women who've shaped all walks of British life, from the 4th century BC to the 21st century. John Bull, 1712 to the present day, fictitious epitomist of Englishness and British imperialism. Written by Miles Taylor. The figure of John Bull first appeared in print in The History of John Bull, a political allegory sometimes wrongly attributed to Jonathan Swift, but now accepted as the work of John Arbuthnot, Queen Anne's physician. The history appeared in 5 parts between March and July 1712, at the time of the War of the Spanish Succession. In this satire, John Bull was a small cloth merchant, embroiled in a lawsuit with his European neighbours, Nicholas Frog, the Dutch, Louis Baboon, Louis Bourbon of France, Philip Baboon, the King of Spain, Esquire South, the Austrian Archduke, Sister Peg, Scotland, and various others. Arbuthnot's work was a thinly veiled attack on the current Whig government's foreign policy, and on the financiers who were benefiting from English intervention in Europe. Arbuthnot's John Bull, introduced as an honest, plain-dealing fellow, choleric, bold, and of very unconstant temper, had prospered from trade, but had been duped by his lawyers and was now suffering financial misery. Arbuthnot's history was not the first portrayal of the archetypal Englishman as blunt, irritable, and prone to take to the bottle, nor the first association of Englishness with bovine characteristics. The bull, the ox, and beef had often symbolised the English nation. Nor was the history the first Tory allegory on the Whig political clique, which had effectively controlled the country's fortunes since the revolutionary settlement of 1688 to 1689. But Arbuthnot was the first to combine all these ingredients in the persona of John Bull. And as such, it remained a remarkably influential work, reprinted in 1727 and 1751, and still inspiring parodies, such as Sister Peg, in 1761. From the 1760s onwards, John Bull began his long history in the visual media as the embodiment not so much of England, but of the English people. The explosion of political propaganda which accompanied the accession of George III in 1760 saw John Bull being drawn by the caricaturists for the first time, initially sometimes as a bull, but increasingly by the 1780s as a shopkeeper or farmer, depending on the artist. Whatever the preferred depiction of the various cartoonists and print sellers, the characteristics associated with John Bull remained quite close to the genre established by Arbuthnot. He was a reluctant nationalist. Reluctant because he knew going to war with other countries meant higher taxes. The focus of his nationalism might change, from the revolutionary Jacobin constitution of the 1790s to Napoleon's nation in arms after 1802. But his reputation as a down-to-earth, liberty-loving, beer-drinking and pugnacious admirer of all things English remained intact. And as in Arbuthnot's original incarnation, the John Bull of the late 18th century print was gullible, lacked much foresight, and was easily led by scheming politicians of all parties. But if the proclivities and preoccupations of John Bull remained constant over time, the late 18th century did see a concerted attack on his status as the authentic everyman of public opinion. Alarmed at the seizure of power by the demos of Paris, the sans-culottes, some caricaturists in 1789, notably James Gilray, produced versions of John Bull which made him appear as a sort of Frankenstein's monster of democracy. Coarse, plebeian, physically disfigured and grotesque. However, other propagandists lauded Bull's loyalism, peasant-like stoicism and deference, and this stereotype became common during the French invasion scares of 1802 to 1803. As the Napoleonic Wars drew to a close and war in Europe gave way to civil instability at home, radical publishers and prints associated with George Cruikshank and William Hone appropriated a tax-hating, free-born John Bull for their own purposes, making him the figurehead of their attacks on old corruption, or, as in an 1816 print, the bearer of the establishment's excessive fiscal burden on the common man. Tory writers responded in kind. At the time of the Queen Caroline affair in 1820, for example, a new John Bull newspaper took George IV's side in the acrimonious attempt to impose a divorce on the estranged Queen. Thus, by the early 19th century, there was as little agreement about who John Bull was as there was consensus about the nation's affairs in general. A more stable version of John Bull began to emerge in the middle decades of the 19th century. As taxes fell and Britain retreated from military involvement on the European continent, the burdens of John Bull lightened. And as the threat posed by republican democracy eased off, the disputes over John Bull's social origins subsided. By the time of the Reform Act of 1832, the rotund, usually rural, shabby farmer, or even squire, was becoming the dominant depiction of John Bull. In this guise, he featured as the bemused but complacent everyman who appeared in Punch from 1842 onwards. John Leech's and John Tenniel's drawings for Punch provide what remains the best-known and most easily recognisable version of John Bull, a portly, ruddy-cheeked and side-whiskered farmer with boots and a shabby hat and an aggressive mastiff at his side. The mid-19th century John Bull was in party terms essentially neutral. His rural appearance did not indicate a preference for instance, a protectionist agenda. And during the heyday of Gladstone and Disraeli, the rival party prince enlisted John Bull with equal credibility. It was left to foreign commentators to produce more pejorative versions. In 1819, the American writer Washington Irving produced a modern rendition of John Arbuthnot's original, attributing England's propensity to meddle in the affairs of other countries to being, as he put it, a little fond of playing the magnifico abroad. Max O'Rell's John Bull and His Island, 1883, extended the criticism, dubbing John Bull an aggressive imperialist, a large landowner with muscular arms, long, broad, flat and heavy feet, and an iron jaw that holds fast whatever it seizes upon. These caricatures began to stick, and overseas representations of John Bull carried in the illustrated press in the last decades of the 19th century invariably represented Bull as a land-grabbing capitalist, annexing more and more of the non-European world. In the Edwardian years, John Bull shed much of his political and social neutrality. As the notion of the English public expanded, especially after the extension of household suffrage to the counties in 1884, the representation of the typical Englishman as a squire or small landowner became more problematic. Repudiating jingoism in the South African War, Canon Scott Holland pronounced the John Bull stereotype ludicrously obsolete, fat in an age when the fat man's day is past and gone. Scott Holland went on to complain that John Bull has no brains, he embodies in his fatuous good humour, in his farmer's suit, in his obvious provincialism, the British horror of ideas. The cartoonists of the labour movement, for example Will Dyson, likewise tended to avoid John Bull if they wished to invoke everyman. And some radical cartoonists of the late 19th century depicted exploitative employers or inhumane agricultural landlords in caricatures remarkably similar to the stock caricature. With the massive increase in the use of political posters after 1885, peaking in the three elections of 1906 and 1910, John Bull's image became traded around with the same degree of competition and contestation that had occurred in the 1790s. Perhaps the most famous version of the Edwardian John Bull came in Horatio Bottomley's eponymous newspaper, which he edited from 1906 to 1921. Bottomley's John Bull, now with a Union Jack waistcoat and dressed out in a top hat, riding gear and crop, rather than in the unkempt farming garb of old, was a persistent critic of the state interventionism of Asquith's Liberal government, and in particular of its fiscal policies. Bottomley's John Bull also savaged the venality and corruption of the Liberal Party's relations with big business. The figure featured heavily too in the free trade versus protection election campaigning which dominated the Edwardian years, with the illustrators of both parties using John Bull to support their calls for either greater indirect or greater direct taxation. The constitutional crisis over the People's Budget, which ran from 1909 to 1911, was the climax of the party political career of John Bull. Thereafter, he still featured in political caricature, increasingly but not always on the conservative end of the spectrum, but more frequently after the First World War as a symbol of imperial nostalgia. John Bull was, for example, a prominent element in the advertising strategy of the Empire Marketing Board in the 1920s and 1930s. Here, as he had been throughout his life, he was supported by Mrs. Bull, now a middle-aged matronly wife who, in David Lowe's cartoons of the 1920s, donned Britannia's helmet. Both figures were joined later by Lowe's youthful flapper, Joan Bull, who epitomised the recently enfranchised woman. Thus, John Bull ended his active political life very much as he had begun it 200 years before, a repository of various meanings and associations, a composite and far from univocal national character. If you enjoyed this life of John Bull, why not visit the Oxford DMB online at www.oxforddmb.com and learn about other people from the past. As well as more podcast episodes, you'll find thousands of interesting people who've shaped every aspect of British history.